downstairs. What's going on?
We need eyeballs, attached to something less conspicuous than a person.
Getting the picture, he drew on the nether and sent it flowing into the rat. It twitched in his pocket. He sent his sight to its, just to test the link, and got a big eyeful of nothing. He frowned, directed it to stick its head out of his pocket, then tried again. His sight leapt downward, showing a blank sandstone wall. After a couple of turns, C stopped in front of an unmarked door.
Leave it here.
He set the rat on the ground. C went inside the door and took a back staircase to the roof of the building. She hunched down and moved to the knee-high wall enclosing the roof. Three stories below, the cramped street was almost pitch black.
You see that doorway?
She whispered, pointing across the way.
Next time someone goes through it, send the rat in after them.
What's this about? We could spend hours up here until someone goes through it. Wrong, Somber murmured. One of them is coming now. He ducked below the retaining wall. Dante followed suit, then delved into the rat's vision. A woman walked down the alley, hands in pockets of her loose white trousers. She stopped in front of the door C had indicated. Dante edged the rat closer. The woman unlocked the door and moved inside. The rat skittered after her into a tight, dark room. It tucked itself into a corner. The woman closed the door and stood in silence. After pausing several seconds, she opened the cover on the lantern she'd been carrying, bathing the room in a weak light. She moved to a frieze on the wall. A line of round, white pebbles bordered it top and bottom. She touched one of the bottom stones, then the one to its right, then the one to its left. A soft, grinding noise sounded from below. A hole opened in the floor as a stone panel swung away into the darkness. The woman stepped onto the ladder down.
What the hell?
Dante said on the roof.
What? C said. Quiet. It's my turn to be mysterious.
The woman shrank from sight, a rung at a time. As soon as her head dropped beneath floor level, Dante sent the rat in after her. It clung tight to the ladder's side. The lantern bobbed on the woman's hip, shining onto a platform a few feet further down. She stepped onto it, reached for a rope looped around a pulley, and cranked the stone panel back into place above her head. A stone staircase descended from the platform. Dante let the woman get a head start, then sent the rat down after her. Sand gritted beneath its paws. The rat's perspective made it difficult to tell for sure, but after what felt like about three flights of stairs, the creature scampered out into a dim cavern. And not a natural one. The floor was paved with bricks. Sand lay thick in their cracks and seams. Buildings loomed in the darkness, looking terribly ancient yet well-preserved. But what drew his eye was the address posts in front of each one. He withdrew his sight from the rat and grinned at C. I think you found our missing building. Chapter 20. The first thing Blaze did was yell at the fish. The second thing he did was wonder if fish had ears. The third thing he did was take a deep breath and swim as fast as he could toward the grinder and the snail it was busy harassing. The fish was so intent on its would-be meal that it didn't notice him until he was within 3 feet. It floated to the side, regarding him without fear. He reached for the snail, careful of its spines, and pulled. It stuck to the rock, then popped free. The grinder darted in for a bite. Blaze swiped at it with his spear. It darted back, hovering out of reach, then turned its tail and flashed away. He kicked upward toward the waning light. Something brushed his hand. He jerked it back, and the snail spun from his grip, wobbling toward the ocean floor. Blaze shouted out, bubbles flowing past his face, and brought up his foot, catching the snail on the flat of his fin.
He snatched it up and surfaced, holding it aloft.
"Is this it?" he said. "Please, please tell me this is it."
Min's grin burst across her face.
"You are currently holding a Kelevert."
"I am? Now what do I do with it?"
"Well, I would either kill it or bring it to shore before it stings you."
At that, he almost dropped it again. For the moment, however, it had sucked itself into its shell. He paddled towards land, keeping both eyes pinned on it for any sign of fangs, stingers, or proboscis. His fin kicked sand. He found his footing and slapped ashore, holding the Kelevert away from his body.
"What's next?" he said. "Do some sort of blessing? An incantation? Or do we wait for Ro to come and cast the spell?"
Min eyed him. She reached into the oiled leather pouch she carried with her at all times and removed a hooked knife and a delicately curved spoon. She took the snail from him and jabbed it with the knife. A bit of fluid dribbled to the sand. She let a few moments pass, then jabbed the knife inside the shell and sawed in a circle. She removed the knife, inserted the spoon, and withdrew a slimy mass of snail and guts. She held it out to him.
"Chow down."
He tapped his thumbnail against his teeth.
"Is this really necessary?"
"This is what the people do."
"Does it help connect you to the power of the shell?"
"Could be. It will certainly help you remember this moment." He moved an inch closer to the damp tube of goo she was offering him.
"What about its venom?"
"Harmless when ingested. It's only dangerous when it stings you." He still couldn't tell if she was joking, but there was only one way to find out. He pinched the tail of the de-shelled snail, tipped back his head, and dropped it in his mouth. He'd intended to swallow it whole, but it was now obvious that would choke him to death. He chomped down, slashing his jaw back and forth to shear it in half. Salt water and bitter juice filled his mouth. He chewed quickly, got half down, gagged, decided gagging was better than holding the rest of it in his mouth for any longer, and swallowed.
"That'll freshen your breath," he said, eyes watering. "How about a celebratory kiss?"
She looked disgusted, then decided this was hilarious.
"Well done. Even if it took you until the very last moment, we were here." "Yes, it was a true display of skills, paddling about in the ocean until I happened on one at random."
"Finding a Kelevert might not be a skill," she admitted, "but persistence is."
"Where do you come up with all these pearls of wisdom?"
"By lazing around in the ocean all day, obviously." He thought there might be some ritual to finalize things or seal the shell to him or what have you, but Min dried off, dressed, and headed toward the cabin. There she cleaned out the shell and rubbed it with a cloth. While she did this, he built up a fire, then sat back from the flames.
"Now what?"
She fixed him with a look of great significance. "Now, you make dinner." He thought this was unfair, given that he was a victorious champion and all, but he was hungrier than the grinder had been. He cooked up some fish they'd caught at dawn.
"I suppose you want to get right to it,"
Min said once they'd finished their meal.
"It had crossed my mind."
"There's something to be said for anticipation."
"Waiting only makes things stale and moldy."
He moved to the table and picked up the empty shell. It was heavy. Solid. His feelings toward it were the confused ambivalence he felt after slaying a worthy foe on the battlefield. Elation for his triumph, but sadness that such a rare creature had been removed from the world.
"I'm tired.
We can wait until tomorrow. But can you at least tell me how it works?" She stood and moved beside him, considering the shell.
"In many ways, I have no idea whatsoever. Here's what we do know about the Kelevert. It's a scavenger, One that prefers its dead fresh. So does the Nether. Wolves and buzzards eat carrion too. But I've never heard of a sorcerer lusting after their bones. For that matter, I've spent long enough staring into tide pools to know that crabs eat dead junk all day too.
But they eat mere flesh. The Kelevert seems to feed on not only the meat, but also on the nether drawn to it.
Why? Blaze drew back his head. Don't tell me they're snails with sorcerous powers. Not that I've seen, she said, amused. I can't tell you why they do it, or how they alone, of all the creatures that we know about, do so. All I can tell you is they seem to store it in their shells. If you have one of those shells, you can draw on what they've collected.
Yeah, but the shadows are in everything, right? Why don't I just go pick up a rock and draw on its nether?
You could, but it wouldn't give you much to work with. It's vastly more concentrated in the shells.
Makes sense, I guess.
He turned the shell over in his hand.
So why does it work best for the person who found it?
I have no idea, Blaze. I'm not an expert on the supernatural qualities of aquatic snails.
Just trying to understand. Wonderful. Meanwhile, in the practical realm, you lack the ability to generate power. This will provide a source of it for you. With any luck, by observing how it provides that power, you'll learn to draw on more of it for yourself.
He tapped one of the spines.
Thank you for having the patience to field my endless questions.
She smiled wryly.
Maybe I'm frustrated that I don't know all the answers. One of the others might know more. They're older than I am, you know.
He shot up his eyebrows.
I hadn't noticed.
She grabbed his collar and pulled his shirt over his face. He clutched the shell tight, careful not to drop it until the assault was over. Prowling the waters until the last of the light had taken a lot out of him, and he slept later than intended, waking mid-morning. Min served him breakfast. After he helped clean out the house, for what good it would do, by the next time the people of the pocket came here, weather and animals would have rendered it filthy again. Once this was done, they carried their few belongings down to the beach. Min spotted the boat first, pointing out its sail. A couple hours later, the outcast ground into the sand. Rose stood at its front, gazing down at him. Blaze held up the shell.
You found one.
She sent her focus winging to the shell's curls.
It's a good one.
Thanks. He glanced at Min, expecting a ceremony to ensue. She passed her gear up to the ship and clambered aboard. He did the same. On the ride back to the cove, he did some mental poking around in the shell. It was indeed a storehouse of nether. The shadows came to him like eager puppies. He looked around for Min, but she was off talking to Ro. He didn't want to get ahead of himself before she had the chance to show him how the Kelevert actually worked, so he limited his explorations. Yet by the time they'd landed on the sands of Pocket Cove, he'd already discovered how to integrate the shell's stored nether into the cycle of the four seasons. He hopped down, helped unload, then splashed over to Min.
Ready to put me through my paces?
How about tomorrow?
What plans could be more important than me?
Ro wants to see to my leg, she said.
Okay. You found the one thing more important.
He couldn't help glancing down at it. Back on Koho, she'd claimed it no longer hurt, but she was still limping. She went inside the caves with Ro and the others. Blaze wandered down to the tide pools to practice with his shell. After spending the last 2 weeks with her, usually separated by no more than a dozen yards, it felt strange to be alone again.
But there were upsides, too, like doing things you weren't supposed to.
He sat down on the rocks and drew a sharpened shell down the back of his left arm. Blood welled from the scratch. Nether leapt from the tide pool. He shaped it into a ball, moved his focus to its center, then reached into the shell. The grape-sized ball of shadows expanded to an apple, then a melon. Blaze laughed. As the darkness neared his face, he flinched, expecting it to be as cold as the sea. But he felt nothing at all. His sight winked off, enveloped by total darkness. He fooled around with this until the sky was as dark as the Shadowsphere, then went to the caves to eat and sleep. In the morning, he was eager to show Min what he'd learned, but he didn't see her. 2 days later, on his way back from hauling water from the falls, he spotted her walking along the sand. "Where'd your limp go?" he said. "Did Ro scare it away?" Min's look was unreadable. "Don't patronize me. She did the best she could, but it will always be there." "It really does look much better. How do you feel?"
"I'm perfectly fine."
She frowned at him.
"Do you feel guilty?"
"I chose to take you to Ko'o. Because I'm so crummy at this, I needed the help of a magic snail. Pocket Cove may be safe, but I'm happy to expose myself to the world, and its dangers, when I get the chance. I'm glad we went. The cost could have been far greater." A smile lifted to the corner of her mouth. "Now show me what you've learned." Blaze glanced downshore toward the pools.
"Have you been spying on me?"
"I don't need to spy to know you'd be too impatient to wait for me."
"How dare you know me so well?"
He laughed, then put on a sly look. "I might have picked up a new trick or two. I'll show you mine if you show me yours."
"For the sake of your health, I hope you're referring to my leg."
"Nope. I want to see you shadow walk."
"I was wondering when you'd ask."
She held her arms out from her sides.
"Don't blink."
She smiled and vanished. Blaze not only blinked, he stumbled back a step, bonking his shoulder into something solid. He whirled and faced empty space. Something tapped his other shoulder. He spun around, but nothing was there either. Min's laughter pealed from the air. She materialized in front of him.
"Okay, now it's time for you to drop your pants, metaphorically speaking."
"Holy shit! How did you do that?"
"How do you think?"
I know, years of practice," he said. "So can you walk through walls?"
Min shook her head.
"Ro, maybe. I'm not sure. I think she gets a kick out of keeping her abilities so mysterious we're willing to believe she can do anything."
"This is how you stay hidden, isn't it? If Modigan launched an armada to come slaughter you, he wouldn't see a single soul. Meanwhile, you'd be fighting not to giggle."
"More or less. Though he has sorcerers of his own. Harder to hide from them."
"Right. Well, I'm going to need you to teach me this. Immediately."
Before she could object, he opened his palm and expanded a pebble of nether until the sphere enveloped his whole body. He dropped his focus, and the darkness snapped away.
Min was smiling.
"So, our weeks on the island weren't a waste." Now that he had a supply of nether and an idea of how to work it, they made good progress. Relatively speaking, anyway. It took multiple days of practice before he was able to create and manipulate shadow spheres at a distance from himself. It seemed pretty elementary. He wasn't doing anything more than making the nether's darkness visible to others, and blowing it into a big old ball. The physical world remained untouched. To test his abilities, she showed him two other things the nether did naturally. Hurting and healing. Blaze proved skilled at neither. Min reminded him that he had already advanced further and faster than most people were capable of, and suggested he continue to practice both abilities. If nothing else, failing at them might help him understand how to do other things better. That night, he exhausted himself with practice. Yet before dawn, he found himself half awake. The animal side of his brain was listening to the rasp of feet out in the hallway. It was very quiet, but that just made his mind more alert to it. So did the fact the steps were slightly irregular. Now fully awake, At least his eyes were open. His bladder began to compete for his attention. He pulled on his shoes and cloak and went outside. It was still dark out. Moonlight shined on the foam of the waves. Not far up the beach, a woman walked to the north. Her silhouette was familiar, but the slight limp confirmed it. He quickly went about his business, then moved to the cliffs and hugged the shadows. He was not surprised when Min entered the enclosed stairwell, up to the fingers. In the tight rock walls, noise echoed explosively, and he had to wait until her footsteps placed her near the top before he dared follow her in. He jogged up lightly. At the exit, he poked up his head and peered into the fog sifting through the fingers. No sign of her. He wandered east and soon heard her murmuring with a man. Like the previous encounter, he hung back. This time, when she wrapped up her conversation and started back toward the stairs, Blaze popped out from behind a rocky column. "What the hell?" she yelled. "Let's get this out of the way. Yes, I was spying on you. And what the fuck makes you think you have the right to do that?" "Because you've been sneaking around and lying to me for months?" He stepped forward. "What's going on? Are you having forbidden relations, Min?" Her mouth fell open. "That's my brother." "So, forbidden in several senses." "Are you jealous?" "I'm not a fan of being kept in the dark by people who are supposed to be my friends." "It's nothing you need to be worried about. I like to keep up with what's happening in our homeland, that's all." She glanced toward the beach below. "You can't tell Ro. We're not supposed to have contact with outsiders, and they're certainly not supposed to be coming up to the fingers." "You've been seeing a lot of him," Blaze said. "Is everything all right out there?" Her eyes skipped between his. "Hard to say. I might not be able to bend the nether if I had a crowbar, but when it comes to intrigue, I've got a lifetime of experience. Why don't you tell me what's going on?" She took a long breath and let out a longer sigh. "I grew up in Galador. My brother still lives there. We don't hear much from the outside world at Pocket Cove, but even I know that in the last few years, Galador has seen more than its fair share of turmoil." Blaze quickly nodded for her to continue. He had been a significant source of that turmoil, and did not want to feel tempted to divulge that. "They've managed to hang on," she said. "They're resourceful people who view setbacks as a new challenge, but over the last few months, things have been..." "If he's coming to you for help, it's got to be extraordinary circumstances." "Right." She shook her head sharply. "But there's nothing I could do about it, even if I wanted." "Because you can't leave the pocket. What will they do to you if you take an unauthorized vacation?" "At best, my Lee would be left in tatters. It would take years of drudge work before I was trusted enough to continue my own training. At worst, they would throw me out. Banish me." He scratched his cheek. "So why not tell Ro you're taking me outside for another lesson?" Her eye gleamed. "I couldn't lie to her. She'd know. Galador's not so far away. We get there in a couple days, check things out, then run back home." "Why would you offer? This doesn't concern you." "It concerns you. Therefore it concerns me." He reached for her arm, but didn't touch it. "Min, fixing odd problems is what I do. I'm something of an expert. You've put your life on hold to teach my bungling ass. The least I can do is help you solve whatever's bedeviling your family." She grimaced at the mist drifting between the pillars. "Maybe you're just restless." "Think what you like," he said, "but do think about it." He headed downstairs. She didn't follow. He was wide awake, so he returned to his practice at the pools, throwing shadow spheres over befuddled crabs. When he tired of that,
He tried to use the nether to hack muscles from the rocks, but the shadows bounced away harmlessly. It was like he couldn't draw them into the real world, or hone what he could sharp enough to leave a mark. He tried to recall his earliest days with Dante, when they'd been kids on the run, and Dante was just learning to harness the nether. Despite being self-taught, Dante had picked it up as easily as Blaze might pick up a rock. Compared to his own travails, it was beyond exasperating. "Let's do it," Min said from behind. He slipped on the rock and splashed halfway into the tide pool. He sat up, spitting salt.
"Lyle's balls, make some noise next time, will you?"
"Did you hear me? I said let's go."
"Wonderful. Let me go pack."
He glanced about himself.
"What do you know? I'm already wearing everything I own."
"Excellent." She turned to go.
"Aren't you going to tell me what this is about?"
"First, I have to get approval for another voyage. I'll tell Ro your studies were stimulated by the last trip."
She wrinkled her nose.
"They're probably going to think this is cover for a tryst."
Blaze chuckled. "How would that affect your Lee?"
"Given my choice of partners, Ro will probably suggest we go to a live volcano this time."
He went back to the caves to clean up and get together a few things.
He had just finished when Min came to his room to let him know they'd been approved to travel to a small island a few miles to the north. To avert suspicion, they'd paddle that way in an outrigger, then swing back to shore, cross the fingers, and beeline to Galador. If they hustled, they had enough time left in the day to plausibly shove off and reach the island before dark. The people docked most of their boats south of the tide pools in a lagoon, and the caves that surrounded it. Blaze and Min jogged to the inlet and hauled an outrigger from a cave into the placid water. No one was there to oversee the boats. The only people who lived here were the people. None would think about taking a boat without authorization, or an emergency too severe to seek it. He and Min loaded food, spare clothes, and camp gear into the canoe, then shoved off. The outrigger yawed over the surf, rising up and splashing down. They fought past it, and Min turned north to run parallel to shore. The boat seemed to skim over the water. Blaze glanced across the sands. A couple of women were out to gather food or take in some fresh air, but no one paid them much mind. The boat was as thin as an arrow and sliced through the water like it had been fired from a longbow. They quickly left the caves behind. An island hung a few miles to the northwest. Min continued to cut north. As the sun neared the water, dazzling and red, she swung back to shore. "We'll stash it here," she said. "Help me haul it in before anyone sees."
The smooth wooden hull ground against the sand. Blaze hopped out and dragged it clear of the waves. It was plenty heavy, but it was built to move. Between the two of them, they lugged it all the way to the cliff face.
Min gestured. "Keep watch a minute."
He nodded and jogged 100 feet south. Min bent over the wall of the cliff. After a couple minutes, she beckoned broadly, gesturing him back to where she had opened a long, slender cave in the wall. They shoved the canoe inside. Min went still, concentrating, and sealed it behind a thin layer of rock. They built a small cairn to mark the spot, memorized a nearby spar that stuck from the cliffs, then headed north, where Min promised there was another staircase. According to her, while there was never more than one leading from outside up to the fingers, there were several connecting the beach to the plateau. Escape routes if the people ever needed to retreat and hide. She located it a few minutes later, checked it for people, then headed up. The fingers were as quiet as ever. Once they were safely concealed in the fog, the shore lost behind them, Blaze slowed down and spread his palms.
"Ever gonna tell me about this mission?"
Min bit her lip, striding over a puddle of mud. It's confusing.
Then start talking. I'll let you know when I stop understanding.
My uncle has a vast library, she said. It's full of oddities. Histories, legends, accounts of the occult. Many of the books in it are original manuscripts. Some never saw a second copy. I used to spend whole days in there reading one tome after another.
She laughed.
Come to think of it, that's probably why I wound up here. I got so ensorcelled by stories of warlocks, heroes, and demons that I decided to become one.
One of the nicer ones, though.
Until I'm not.
She smiled.
Uncle Denny's library is private, but sometimes he opens it to collectors, dealers, or scholars. A few months ago, a woman asked to see it. She said she was from Narashtavik, and...
What does she look like?
I don't know, I wasn't there.
He bowed an apology.
Please go on. Under his supervision, he allowed her to have a look around. She was immediately interested in a book called The Almanac of the Seasons of Heaven. Uncle Denny was surprised. It's one of the oldest books in his collection, which he researches like a fiend, but no one has ever asked him about it before. She wanted to buy it. The offer was outrageous, but my uncle is already rich, and with his curiosity piqued, he demurred. 3 days later, she doubled her offer.
And tripled his suspicions.
Min nodded. He doesn't like selling anyway, would rather trade for other books, but he began to think there might not be anything worth trading the almanac for. He refused again. A few weeks after that, while he was traveling, his home was broken into. The library was ransacked, but when he reshelved it and compared it to his inventory, not one book was missing.
Blaze rubbed the back of his neck.
Because he'd already hidden the almanac in a vault? He wasn't that canny. He'd brought it to a scholar to try to learn more about it. But yes, it wasn't in the house. After the break-in, he knew better than to leave it lying around.
Curious stuff, but unless there's another leg to this story, I wouldn't think a failed book heist would be enough to draw you out of the pocket.
Not at all, she said. But when they couldn't steal the book, they stole my cousin instead.
Kidnapped him? Over a book?
My brother came here as fast as he could. My uncle is ready to hit the warpath. But if the woman is from Narashtavik, then the only way to fight her is to bring in another Nethermancer.
Blaze trudged up a short rise of rock. Or just give them the book.
Uncle Denny would, in a heartbeat. But they haven't asked for the book. They haven't contacted him at all. If it were as simple as that, I would have left with my brother on the spot.
Well, whatever's going on, it sounds like the sort of thing Ro would understand you need to go deal with.
Min laughed wryly. When we come to the pocket, we leave the outworld behind. All of it. Our pasts, our homes, our families. The mere fact I've kept in contact with mine would be enough to ruin my Li.
And your reputation's more important to you than your family?
I made a choice to leave my old family, she said, but I could never bear the thought of leaving my family at Pocket Cove.
That was all the information she had.
Blaze wasn't sure what she'd told him was enough to risk running afoul of Ro. On the other hand, if they were caught, he expected Min would be granted much more mercy than he would. Anyway, it didn't matter what kind of risk he faced. He owed it to Min. She'd taken him in when he'd had nowhere else to go.
Dusk fell while they were still in the middle of the Fingers, but staying there for the night meant risking discovery at the hands of anyone patrolling the border between Pocket Cove and the Outlands. Unable to use a light, they were forced to slow their pace, picking their way across the slippery rock. As they stepped down a natural shelf of stone, he slipped in the mud. He went down hard, ankle buckling. Somehow he managed not to scream. Min dropped down beside him. Nether swarmed. His leg numbed, went warm. He rolled his ankle around and felt a sharp twinge.
Hang on, she warned.
He did so.
She was a skilled nethermancer, and he knew his leg would be fine in a moment. He'd gotten so used to working with a miracle maker, however, that he found himself impatient when it took her more than a moment to get him back on his feet. When he tested his ankle, there was the mere ghost of pain. They trudged on, but it took 2 hours to cross the fingers and turn south to the stairwell to the plains. They descended from the mist. Clouds streaked the dark sky, but the grassy ground was firm. They walked on, wanting to be out of sight of the fingers, before pitching camp. Around midnight, with a wedge of a moon sailing toward the west, they hunkered down on the far side of a short hill to sleep. Sunrise showed a world Blaze hadn't seen in weeks. Even the air felt different, sharper and drier. On the coast, the light glowed like something from another world, but here it was hard and stark. The air was colder, too. The ocean kept the cove a steady temperature, day or night. On the prairie, the grass glittered with frost. But it felt good. He figured they had about a 4-day walk to the lakes. Then they'd catch the fastest boat they could find to the city of Wending, where Min's uncle lived. Assigned the same amount of time for the return trip, and that reduced their available time in Galador to 5 or 6 days. Min must have been having similar thoughts. She surprised him by starting the day at a jog.
"Sure, that's a good idea," he said. "My body will let me know if it isn't."
She was able to jog a few miles at a stretch before slowing to walk. A couple miles later, she resumed jogging. If a shark ever ate part of him, Blaze resolved to go see Roe first thing. By the end of the day, the mountains of Galador Rift were a blue smear on the eastern horizon. On the second day, they reached the foothills, lush rises of bamboo and shrubbery. The third day saw them cross the pass. A vast lake shined below. Farms terraced the slopes. Though it was still winter, the smell of tea bushes hung in the air. It was dark by the time they descended to a town on the shores of the western lake, but Min headed straight to the docks and hired passage on one of the taxi galleys that serviced the lakes. She had nothing resembling money, yet the fare seemed no problem for her. The splash of the oars carried through the darkness. Lanterns drifted over the lake, hung from the prows of other vessels. The galley plowed straight toward a bank of cliffs, separating one lake from the next, slipped into the channel connecting them, then swung southeast. Across the lake, lights shined from Wending. As they approached, Blaze picked Lolligan's island home from the miniature archipelago extending from shore. They made port, debarked, and hired a personal rowboat, again without exchanging any funds. The boat threaded through the wee islands, depositing them at a larger one that appeared to be shared between 3 or 4 estates. They climbed onto a pier, housing an array of vessels ranging from canoes to a 3-masted flagship. Their rower cleared his throat. Min promised she'd be right back with his payment. She jogged up the steps, leading to a sprawling home built in Galadese style, boxy towers capped by flared eaves. Candles burned in the windows. Min strode across the deck and knocked on a side door. A minute later, 2 men answered. Both held swords at the ready.
"Hello, Jinsen," Min said. "Is my Uncle Denny home?"
The larger and older of the 2 men squinted. An instant later, his eyes went wide.
"Minimer?"
"Minim," Blaze began, then cut himself short when Min's glare warned him he'd die.
"I had to take a taxi," she said to Jinsen. "He's at the pier, awaiting payment."
Jinsen sheathed his weapon and turned to the other bodyguard, who gazed back dully, then rocked forward and jogged across the deck toward the pier. Jinsen sighed.
"You've heard, then. And I wish I would have been brought back by happier circumstances," Min said. "Then again,
Happy circumstances wouldn't have been strong enough to bring me back.
I don't think your uncle's asleep yet. The big man glanced up at the manor's towers. But if he is, he won't mind waking.
He showed them inside, lighting more candles around the dim rooms. Min threw herself into a stuffed chair, wrenched off her shoes, and rubbed her feet. Blaze suddenly felt as tired as she looked. Knowing he'd fall asleep if he sat down, he leaned his elbows on the back of a chair, alternating which foot he placed his weight on. Within a minute and a half, a 60-year-old man swept into the room, dressing robe flapping behind him. He spared Blaze a quick look, then crushed Min to his chest.
"Where have you been?"
he gasped. Min fought to free her mouth from his shoulder.
"Somewhere I wasn't supposed to leave, and have to return to all too quickly.
I'm happy to see you, Uncle Denny, but I'm here to help with Cal."
The man stepped back, sniffling, and took her in.
"How did you hear?
Does it matter?"
He laughed, tucking his chin to his chest.
"You may be my brother's daughter, but your brusqueness is all mine. How much do you know?"
He jerked a thumb at Blaze. "And who the hell is this?"
"My student," Min said.
Blaze moved from around his chair.
"Best if you don't know my name.
The good news is, people like me generally have to go nameless for a reason." Denny stuck out his hand and shook.
"Then I guess I'll call you Blank."
Blaze grinned in dumb shock, then realized the man didn't know his name after all.
"Works for me. Last we heard, your son had just gone missing. Have there been any developments since?"
The man's hands curled into fists, but he couldn't hide his grief from his face or voice.
"Nothing for days.
Then, not 2 hours before you arrived, they sent a message. But there were no words. Just one of his fingers."
Chapter 21 C shoved his shoulder.
"Quit with the mystery. What are you seeing in there?"
"Not in," Dante said. "Down. There's a city hidden below this one."
"I knew it!"
"Well, I don't remember you placing that bet,"
Sombra said. She rolled her eyes.
"I told you they were meeting up somewhere."
"That's a far cry from predicting it would be in a subterranean mirror city."
Dante looked between them. "How did you know to watch this doorway in the first place?"
"We were running down transposed addresses," C said, "asking more people about 327 East. Things like that. We're talking to this one guy, and he starts to blurt something out. Then he thinks better, says he doesn't know. I think maybe he had it confused with a different address, remembered the right one mid-sentence. An hour later, I remember he was wearing a grey scarf."
"The significance being..."
"In most cities? None. But look around. The Camrish dressed like they slept in a rainbow."
"Whereas this guy was trying to look bland."
Dante shifted his knees. The rooftop was solid stone and he was getting sore.
"That's a little flimsy." "By itself," C said. "But this wasn't the first one I'd seen. Earlier I watched a woman in a grey scarf open a locked door and enter a blank room. No exits besides the way she came in, not even a window. We had stopped for a meal and were sitting around, so I kept my eyes on the place. A few minutes later, another man opens the door, and the woman's gone."
"That's weird. On the other hand, last week we were living in a metropolis made of 500-foot trees."
"Granted, everything's weird here. My thinking was, maybe one of these little rooms is our missing address."
She produced a knife and waved it mock-menacingly. "Now that I've spent the last 5 minutes explaining what brought me here, you want to tell me what I found?"
"Buildings," Dante said. "People. Business. They have address posts down there, too, but the numbers aren't contiguous."
"Because they're the missing ones," C chortled, rubbing her hands together, and stood.
"Shall we?"
"The only thing I shall be doing is making sure I'm not walking into a bear trap," Sombo said. If they go to such lengths to keep this mirror city concealed, and to identify those who belong and those who don't, that suggests hostility toward interlopers. Dante tapped the stone barrier, ringing the roof. The monk in Kaul sent us here to find this. He wouldn't put us underground if we'd wind up hanged by our own intestines. Perhaps he intended to provide us with a code word, or a passphrase, but was unable due to the intervention of the minister.
Aren't we overthinking this? Lou said.
Everyone turned to him. He squirmed at the attention.
I mean, why don't we buy some gray scarves?
Because that would make too much sense, Dante said.
Well, unless any of you knows of an all-night scarfery, I suppose we'll have to wait until morning.
You want a scarf? C said. I can get you a scarf in 2 hours, fringe or no fringe?
No fringe. In the meantime, I'll continue to reconnoiter below.
After a brief logistical discussion, she departed with Somber and asked. Lou stayed on the roof with Dante. Not that Dante was much in the way of company at the moment. His presence was embedded in the rat. It padded down the dark, quiet streets of the caves, swinging its head from side to side. At least a quarter of the buildings were no more than ruins. Often, a single wall protruded from a bed of rubble. Another quarter were intact, but not for much longer. That left fully half of them usable and livable, however. The streets were far quieter than the ones above, but it was late at night, and he had no way to know whether this place operated on the same routines as people who were exposed to sunlight. Between the rubble, the peacefulness, and the air of antiquity, the sub-city most reminded him of Narashtovik, not the vibrant city it was today, but the one he'd encountered when he first came to it, a diminished echo of a hardier past. Navigation was confusing. There was very little light. In places, the cavern roof plunged to the floor to form giant support pillars, some of which turned thoroughfares into dead ends. Unlike above, the streets were rarely marked. To make everything that much harder, Dante was observing things from a rat's perspective, that is, from 2 inches off the ground. Yet after several minutes of wandering, he located Iden Street, number 327 East. It was a square sandstone building, old but maintained well. He posted the rat across the street to watch. Lou was shaking him. Dante reverted to his own eyes. C strode across the roof, scarves fluttering from her hand.
Get pretty and let's go.
Dante wrapped one around his neck.
I don't think we should all go. There aren't many people down there. We'll be too conspicuous.
I'll stay, Lou volunteered.
I'm going, C said. No way I'm sitting around on the roof while you explore a hidden city.
I suppose my presence is mandatory, Ast said.
Which leaves me on the roof, Somber said. I'm not sure that's wise. You always treat things too lightly.
Dante laughed, because I don't spend so much time looking over my shoulder that my feet get screwed into the ground.
Because of the attitude displayed by statements like that.
He pressed his lips together.
You have ways to reach me, if you find trouble.
Whatever we find, you'll hear about it. Dante walked to the roof's stairs. His sword bounced on his hip on the way down. On the ground, he paused to revisit the rat and confirm that at least one of the scattered pedestrians in the undercity was visibly armed, too, and thus they wouldn't be stopped on the spot. They crossed the alley to the door. It was firmly locked. Dante swore. C produced a kit of metal prongs and got to work. Dante barely had time to look both ways and confirm they weren't being watched before she had it open.
I can see we'll have to invest in extra locks around the citadel, he said.
He stepped inside the dark, cramped room. It smelled like dust. Once C and Ast were in, and the door was closed, he shaped the nether into a soft, pale light and moved to the frieze. The white stones bordering its lower edge all felt loose in their fittings. He pressed one, then the one to its right, then the one to its left.
Stone ground against itself. Sea whirled around and swore. The smell that wafted from below was difficult to place. A little musty, yet also the smell of a dry space that had remained undisturbed for a long time. The scent of inoffensive antiquity. Dante had a conventional lantern, and not wanting to announce to the world that he was a nethermancer, he snuffed his white light and lit the lantern instead. He descended the ladder, waited for the others to join him on the platform, then pulled on the rope, swinging the false floor back into place. Nether, ready at hand, he headed down the stairs. Halfway down, steps whispered below him. He paused. A man's face appeared in the gloom. Dante resumed, walked forward. They passed each other with a faint nod. At the bottom, C took a quick look around and laughed once. Why would people live underground? Dante shrugged. Maybe they don't want people to see what they do here.
Maybe they don't want people to know they exist at all, Ast said.
Dante had kept a bit of his focus on the rat all the while, and as they headed down the cracked pavement of the street, he noticed movement in its vision. Someone was going inside, number 327.
Good news, he murmured. It's occupied.
Their clothing drew a few looks from the people walking down the streets, but either the scars were doing their jobs, or the residents of the sub-city were less xenophobic than Somber believed. No one attempted to stop them. After several minutes of walking and two wrong turns into dead ends of rock, they stood across from their destination.
Well? C said.
Hang on a second, Dante muttered.
For what? Them to invite you inside the secret underground lair? Walk up and knock?
Will do. If they attempt to kill us, I assume you'll have the courtesy to throw yourself on their swords while I run away.
Before she could say more, he crossed the street. The downstairs windows were shuttered, but lights peeped through the cracks. Candles flickered upstairs. As he neared, laughter burst from inside, startling him. He clenched his teeth and knocked on the front door. Chairs scraped. People spoke in furtive voices. Beside him, C and Ast met his eyes. He got out a knife and made a quick cut on the top of his forearm.
Drop that god's damn knife!
Dante tipped back his head. People leaned from each of the four upper windows. They held bow-like weapons. But instead of being held vertically, these weapons were stretched horizontally, secured crosswise on the top of a short shaft. Spiked iron tips reflected the light of the candles. Dante lowered his hand and let his knife fall to the sand piled beside the door.
I'm not here to hurt anyone.
Really, the archer said, because it looks like you're trying to commit suicide by crossbow. Hands on your head.
This is a mistake. The monk sent us.
Above, the man laughed, giving one of his comrades an incredulous look.
The monk? In that case, let me throw down my weapon.
The monk from Kaul, Dante said. He serves at the shrine of Dirison.
The man quit laughing and glanced at the woman in the neighboring window. She shrugged. They hissed something back and forth. The man took on an aggrieved look and withdrew from the window.
Stay where you are, the woman said, keeping her bow aimed at Dante's chest.
He nodded. The nether swam in his hands as thickly as flies on a summer corpse. The front door banged open. A young woman regarded him, a thin sword angling from her hand.
What was his name? She said softly.
The monk. Dante said. I don't know.
Nor how to knock.
She watched him, then twitched up the tip of her blade. I never learned his name because we were run out of call before we had the chance to speak.
So how did you know to come here?
As we were being run out of town, the monk gave me this.
With slow, obvious gestures, Dante opened his cloak and withdrew the tiny scrolls C had nabbed from the monk. He handed it over to the young woman. She took it with her free hand and raised it high enough to keep an eye on him while reading its contents. Her eyebrows flickered. "Why were you forced to leave Coral in such a rush? You couldn't tell each other your names."
"Because the minister threatened to throw me off the top of the tree if I didn't."
She lowered her sword and smiled crookedly. "Why don't you come inside?" He retrieved his knife, then stepped inside a surprisingly airy chamber. The house was small, but it was built into a cave wall, extending back through the rock. A motley bunch watched him impassively, bearing swords and crossbows at a ready but not entirely aggressive position. The young woman took them down the hallway to a large room with a low-slung table in the center and bookshelves and pillows around the walls. Candles burned in the chandelier, providing the most light he'd seen since descending.
"Be seated," the woman said, "and please have some water."
Dante eyed her as she poured a draught into a ceramic mug, but saw no sign of her adulterating the water. He sipped. It tasted dusty, but otherwise pure. There was hardly enough for two swallows. She passed the mug to Ast, and C, took a fourth for herself, drank, and knelt beside the table. "My name is Casey Gage," she said. "And I think you might be Dim walking up to us like that, but Jotun isn't. He sent you here for a reason."
"Jotun is our mutual friend," Dante said. "It doesn't sound like you knew him long enough to forge a friendship. So what is it about you that earned his trust?"
"It might help me answer that if you tell me who you are."
She had a good laugh at that.
"You first. I never strip until I know it's worth my while."
He leaned forward and rested his elbows on the table. "What we have here is a classic trust problem."
"I get it. Throwing your truth on the table leaves you vulnerable. Same for me. Or maybe I'm just a prick. Either way, neither one of us wants to make the first move."
She flicked a button on the front of her shirt.
"It seems to me you're the seeker. That means you want it more."
"You don't even know what it is. And I don't know if you'll be able to provide it."
"Like you said, classic trust problem. Let's see if we can come at this sideways. Why did the minister throw you out of Spiren?"
"Because we failed to register as foreigners."
"Wrong."
She pulled her feet out from under her and sprawled back on her palms. "Foreigners who don't register get a warning and a fine. They sure as shit don't get called in to see the minister. Not unless you've done something he can't abide."
C laughed.
"The way you talk about him makes it sound like we're on the same side."
Dante was about to reprimand her, but Casey gave C her crooked smile, then turned back to him.
"Give us a hint."
The way things were headed, they'd be going in circles all night. He closed his eyes.
"The Black Star. As soon as we mentioned it, Jotun perked right up."
"Well, that would make an awful lot of sense, given the minister's doing everything he can to find it." Dante's heart pounded.
"Do you know where it is?"
"If I did, you think I'd be sitting in a glorified basement?"
Casey folded her fingers together.
"What's your interest in the Black Star?"
"Your turn to answer a question. Who are you, and why did Jotun send us to you?"
"I imagine he thought we could help each other. I think he was right. First, we're going to have to address this trust issue. I got things need doing. Can you do them for me?"
"Do they require a great deal of travel, pain, or food deprivation?" Dante said.
She chuckled and rested her forearms on the table.
"I'll reveal the dice under my cup. I don't feel too favorable toward the minister. If you can snatch his prize, then I help myself by helping you. Before we get to that, I got to know you're not some wicked spy.